Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel. And today we are pleased and indeed honored to have with us General the Lord Dunnott, who from 2006 to 2009 was Chief of the General of the Defense Staff of the British Army. And today we're discussing his book, co-authored with Robert Lyman, Victory to Defeat, the British Army, 1918-1940, published by Osprey. Welcome, Lord Dunnott.
Yes, welcome, and thank you very much for having me on your podcast.
General, what would you say, if it had one, would be the thesis of your book?
The book is a study of the interwar years between 1918 and 1940, and it endeavours to explain how come that the British Army with allies defeated the Germans on the battlefield in November 1918, but less than 22 years later, the revived German army defeated the British and the French armies. So what happened in that 22-year period to turn a success on the battlefield into a disaster on the battlefield? That is the main theme that we endeavour to explore in the book.
What was the significance of Ludendorff's spring offensive in 1918?
Well, Ludendorff, in his spring offensive, saw this as the last chance for the German army to win the war before the United States Army had entered the fray in a meaningful fashion. He knew that once the American forces arrived in great strength, then frankly Germany's chances would be gone. So he threw everything that he had in March 1918 in the German spring offensive.
And why did that offensive fail?
It failed because he had a well-thought-through operational plan, a master plan, to what to do with the various German armies. But he had surprisingly good success against the British Fifth Army, and they changed the point of main effort. You can perhaps explain, understand why they decided to exploit the success against the Fifth Army and to drive towards the Carroll Tunnels. But the problem that that then created for the Germans was that all their logistic supplies had been set up to support their original main effort. But when Ludendorff decided to switch his main effort, he found that he hadn't got the logistic supplies that he needed. And the other thing, and this is an important point, that the reason, part of the reason for their original success, was their stormtrooper groups, who were lightly armed, bypassed the Allied strong points and moved quite quickly into the Allied rear areas. And when that began to happen, it caused a fair degree of panic and concern, such that Haig was even considering withdrawing the British Army back to the Channel ports. So the initial success came about because Ludendorff followed his original plan, which, as I say, as an operational level plan, was a good plan. The tactical success came from the groups of stormtroopers, but they could only move on foot. They became exhausted. They overran, and he fatally switched his point of main effort, and his logistic supply could not support his switch. And that gave the opportunity for the British and the French to plan their own counterattack, which, of course, was what was fully developed during the remainder of 1918.
And why did the British and their allies in the last 100 days of the Great War succeed where the Germans failed?
Well, the 100 days campaign eventually showed that the British in particular had learned the lessons, the harsh lessons of the earlier years of the war. If we have to go back to 1916, on that fateful day, the 1st of July 1916, the worst, blackest day in the British Army's history, when over 20,000 British soldiers were killed on that one day alone. Now, that offensive was launched on the Somme at the behest of the French to take the pressure off the French, who were really struggling at Verdun. But the army that attacked on the 1st of July 1916 was the new Citizen Army, the new army formed after the original regular army had been destroyed in the opening year or so of the First World War. But that new army was only really capable of operating on fixed lines, getting out of their trenches, moving in a slow pace under the protection, it was hoped, of massed artillery. But by 1918, the army had become much more sophisticated. Tanks had been introduced onto the battlefield. So what we saw in the 100 Days campaign was the integration of armour with infantry. The infantry no longer just with a rifle, but with grenades and a much larger number of portable machine guns, supported by much more accurate artillery, supported also by air power, and all this brought together by more modern communications. So what the British had managed to do was reintroduce manoeuvre onto the battlefield. And frankly, to that, the German army, in its exhausted state, frankly, had no answer. So it is fair to say that in the 100 Days campaign, when the British pushed the Germans back to the Hindenburg Line and beyond, the German army was indeed defeated on the battlefield in France.
Would it be true to say that you adhere to what in the literature is referred to as the learning curve thesis in terms of the eventual success of the British Army in the Great War?
Indeed. And this is really a very key point, which is developed further in the book. The British Army had thought through how to break the power of defensive lines by, as I was just mentioned, the integration of infantry, armour, artillery, air power all together. But the sadness is that once the war was over, there was this absolute determination that the First World War had been so awful that it was indeed to be the war to end wars. There must never be another war like this. And that produced a decision by the British government to bring in the 10-year rule, that there would not be another major war in Europe for 10 years. And that policy was renewed year on year. So there was no requirement for the British Army to maintain its war-fighting skills that it had acquired in 1917, 1918, and demonstrated in the 100 Days campaign. And indeed, this is where geopolitical influences become very significant. Britain had her empire to look after, and the British Army, frankly, got back to traditional soldiering, policing the empire in India, in Egypt, in other parts of the world. And the expertise that had been built up in terms of modern war fighting on the battlefield, frankly, was atrophied as the army got back to its traditional activity of policing the empire. That was a real tragedy.
General, what do you mean by the expression war fighting?
Yes, I'm glad you've asked the question, because it is a word that's fallen into the military lexicon. And basically what I'm saying, it's fighting an all-arms manoeuvre battle at high-intensity levels. It's a slightly shorthand term, war fighting, but what I'm really meaning is exactly what I've just said. All arms integrated together at high intensity levels. That's what we mean by war fighting, as opposed to peacekeeping.
How would you say the British Army handled the challenges of the post-Great War period?
Well, I think that's really the point that I'm trying to make. The British Army was very much tasked with getting on with policing the empire. It also picked up under the League of Nations additional responsibilities, one of which was the mandate for Palestine. Britain had played a major part in the defeat of the Turks and the Ottoman Empire in 1917-1918 in Palestine, and therefore became responsible for the mandate for Palestine. Also at the same time, the Irish independence movement, which had been very active up until the First World War. During the First World War, the Irish nationalists pretty much put their cause on the back burner. But that, as soon as the war was over, independence for Ireland became a very hot topic. And indeed, military unrest in Ireland became significant. So the point I'm making is that The British Army found itself having to look in many, many directions after the First World War, looking to the Empire, looking to Palestine, also looking to Ireland. And it allowed the lessons that it has learned to gradually be forgotten. Now, the sadness in all this is that it was the Germans that studied rather more diligently the reasons why they had been defeated on the battlefield in 1918. They realized that the British integration of armor and infantry and artillery and air power together was the formula for the modern warfare. And they also realized that their initial success in the spring offensive had come with these stormtrooper groups who managed to get into the rear area. So combined the understanding, the principle of stormtroopers breaking through into rear areas, combine that with armoured and motorised soldiers integrating, as the British had, armour and infantry and artillery and air power together. That gave you the beginnings of the military capability that Germany had to develop and demonstrate what we subsequently described as Blitzkrieg. Now, of course, during the period up to Hitler coming to power, the German army was limited by the Treaty of Versailles to just 100,000 people. But it was 100,000 strong with a disproportionate number of officers and non-commissioned officers, so that when it was going to expand in the future, it had the skeleton and the framework to do that. But they'd also been doing their doctrinal and conceptual development so that they understood, once the moment for expansion came, how they wanted to create their force, which, of course, we saw dramatically demonstrated when the Germans attacked Poland in 1939 and then attacked in May 1940 through the Ardennes.
What explains the relative lack of success of the British military in Ireland after 1918?
The lack of success by the British military was entirely due to the fact that you were never going to be able to solve the problem in a military way. The growing majority of the people in Ireland wanted to have independence. Ideally, they wanted the whole of Ireland to be independent, but then, as we know, the compromise was that the six of the nine counties of the northern province of Ulster, which were predominantly Protestant, would remain part of the United Kingdom, and the remainder of Ireland would become the Irish Free State. And that was what the majority of the people wanted, and that was what the British government in Westminster reluctantly came to accept. And you knew amount of military endeavour was going to change that situation. I mean, I think this is a classic insurgency, counterinsurgency situation where, frankly, it's all about the hearts and minds of the people. And once the nationalist Catholic majority on the island of Ireland had insisted that it wanted independence from Great Britain, that's what it was going to get, and the Westminster government eventually conceded, with the exception of those six counties of Ulster, which became Northern Ireland, and that required the country to be renamed the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland.
Why do you say, quote, during the interwar period, in the War Office, the future had no champion, unquote?
Well, this is a part of the explanation as to why the British Army was so unprepared to fight a peer opponent when war came again in 1939. As I've already explained, the experiences of the latter years of the First World War gave the British Army great operational capability, had reintroduced manoeuvre onto the battlefield. But as I've been explaining, the army got back to normal soldiering, it got back to peacetime soldiering, it got back to policing, the empire, with all the other pressures that we've just been talking about. And there was nowhere in the British military hierarchy where doctrinal and conceptual thinking was housed. It wasn't in the War Office, it wasn't in Army headquarters, it was nowhere. So the army just got on with what it was getting on with on a daily basis, which was, as I've said several times, frankly, policing the empire, doing what he had to do in Ireland and so on and so forth. So whereas in Germany, you had a very rigorous analysis of what had happened in the First World War, a decision that their future doctrine would go in a certain direction, their force development went in a certain direction to support that doctrine and those concepts. That was not happening in Britain. There were some discussions, some quite heated discussions about the role of the tank on future battlefields. And there were some limited experiments in the late 1920s, early 1930s, with an experimental armoured force. But it never had the blessing, the endorsement from the army leadership that it would have required to change the army in the way that the German army was being changed. And the point that I'm making just now, there was no home where doctrine could be housed and doctrine could be developed. By the time it came to 1939, the British Army had modernised itself a fair degree. It had motorised itself. It went to war in lorries and buses, but it found itself facing the German force that was significantly armoured. So it was an armoured force fighting a motorised force. And again, part of the failure here was that there was nobody imagining what a future war would look like. Nobody had thought through how the capability that the British had developed in 1918 would have been developed over the next 5, 10, 15 years, even if they hadn't done it themselves, how another army could have done it, and they found themselves facing that. So the British Army in 1939, when attacked in France in May 1940, found itself fighting an army that it just didn't recognise, but it should have done, because in fact it had learnt the lessons 20 years before, but hadn't developed them themselves. Sorry, apologies for just coughing. It's also interesting to realise that it was not until 1932 that the British Army published its lessons learnt from the First World War, and even then those lessons learnt dwelt on the failures of 1916, not the successes of 1918.
What you say, would you actually be the case for, say, someone like General Fuller?
Well, the thing about General Fuller, JFC Fuller and Captain Basil Little Hart, they were great proponents of the tank, no doubt about that. But they were such extreme exponents of the tank that they overstated their argument. Now, and it took the first couple of years of the Second World War for this debate to play itself out. It largely played itself out on the sand table of North Africa in the Western Desert. And it took quite some time for the British Army to realise that German armour didn't operate like a land fleet of battleships. Actually, the success of German armour was because German armour was integrated with anti-tank weapons, with panzer grenadier, armoured infantry soldiers, in a integrated fashion. And of course, the irony was that's what the British had done back in 1918. But the proponents of the tank, JFC Fuller and Basil Little Hart, overstated the importance of the tank, and rather overlooked, and the rest of the army overlooked, that the real use of the tank was when it was fully integrated with infantry, artillery, and air power. The Germans twigged onto this and developed their very capable strike forces, but the British didn't. It took quite some time for the British to understand how to use their armour properly, which they eventually did by the end of the Western Desert campaign. And then, of course, once the Second Front began, we saw armour used in a different way in 1944 onwards.
Why were the British government and the British people so opposed to what the late Sir Michael Howard referred to as the Continental Commitment?
Well, if you have to look right back in British history, Britain had fought many wars on the continent, but had never stationed forces on the continent. And in fact, the only time we have done that over an extended period, really, was after 1945, when Britain, along with other NATO allies, stationed forces to front up and face up to the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union. Throughout history, Britain had fought many wars in Europe, yes, of course, but usually we were fighting as part of a coalition. If you look at Wellington's army at Waterloo, yes, there were significant elements of the British army, but frankly, there were other Allied armies there. And of course, as we know, by the end of the day of battle at Waterloo, it was the arrival of Blücher's Prussians that that turned the battle. So Britain has always avoided a continental commitment. Britain as an island had always seen its protection and its strength coming from the Royal Navy. And the role of the army, as I've said several times in this conversation, was to police the empire. And indeed, the way the British army was structured was that every regiment had two regular battalions. One was at home training and recruiting, and the other was somewhere in the empire carrying out this policing of the empire function. And that actually meant that the army in the UK in the interwar years was very much a recruiting and training organisation. It didn't actually form a field force of any great capability that could have deployed into France or elsewhere. And then, indeed, there's a very respectable argument that when Hitler had begun to press in the mid-1930s, reoccupying the Rhineland, Sudetenland, and then, of course, when he went into Czechoslovakia, prompting the Munich crisis and all the rest of it. If Britain had had a force of, let's say, 4 to 6 divisions, properly trained, organised and equipped with a good understanding of war-fighting doctrine, back to that expression again, and had deployed it to France to stand alongside the French, it's quite possible that that could have deterred Hitler from the expansionism that he had in mind. And, of course, this is a really important point. When you've got an army in being and are prepared to use it to deter, you actually have the chance of preventing war. So, by extension, if Britain had had a well-trained force of 4 to 6 divisions and had deployed it to France in 1939 or 1938, it could have prevented the Second World War with all that terrible bloodshed. And, of course, it would also have prevented the Holocaust. That's a thought that's worth thinking about.
Following from that, why was the UK so unwilling to take at face value the threat to European security coming from Hitler's Germany, and in particular the case of Neville Chamberlain?
Well, I think it goes back to the point I made a few minutes ago. The First World War was so disastrous in terms of cost, both in treasure and particularly in blood. I mean, hardly a village or town was not affected, with some of its citizens, young people, being killed, that there was an absolute determination that the First World War must be the war to end wars. There was the 10-year rule, that there'd be no major war in Europe for 10 years, and that rolled on. And therefore, when Hitler came to power in 1933, the decision was to try and talk him down, try and talk him out of what he seemed to be suggesting he was going to do. The policy which became known as appeasement, that was the preferred policy of the British government. Now, of course, because they hadn't reimagined in the way I was describing before how another European war could be fought, there wasn't serious rearmament going on. The British armed forces, with the exception of the Navy, were pretty weak. The Air Force was in its infancy. The Army was, as I've said many times, preoccupied with policing the empire abroad. So the British government didn't actually have a military, credible military capability that it could threaten Hitler with. So therefore, it really didn't have much alternative other than to use words and frankly, the weak tools of appeasement. I think it's Theodore Roosevelt later on in life said that the big trick of statesmanship is to talk quietly while holding a big stick. Well, frankly, Neville Chamberlain talked loudly, but he didn't carry a stick at all, and he carried an umbrella.
I see, yes. Very good. Why, in fact, did Chamberlain favour the RAF over the British Army in terms of funding?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, this was a mantra that grew in the 1930s, building on the early influence of air power towards the end of the First World War. And that mantra was that the bomber will always get through. H.G. Wells, his War of the Worlds book, sort of played this up. And there was a real fear that the bomber was going to be the weapon of the next war, not just dropping high explosives, maybe dropping chemical weapons as well. And that fear was translated when rearmament began in the late 1930s into aircraft production. And initially, the British government decided that it would build itself a bomber force. And only very late in the day did they realise, actually, that what was really, really needed was a fighter force. And just in the nick of time, production lines were set up that sufficient numbers of Spitfires and Hurricanes became available just in time. The British Army, having been defeated on the battlefield in France, allowed the fighters of the Royal Air Force to win the Battle of Britain in September, or August, September, October, 1940.
Do you adhere or agree with the argument made in defense of Chamberlain's policy at the Munich conference that by delaying war for 1 year, Great Britain was able to catch up to some extent in terms of military preparations to Hitler's Germany?
Well, that's often said, and of course, in many ways, that was what happened. I think one of the great debates in history was whether that was a conscious decision by Chamberlain, who maybe, it could be argued, by that stage realised that his country was pretty poorly equipped, pretty poorly defended, and therefore to do anything possible to buy time would give that bit of time for rearmament to really kick in. And go back to my last point, then a re-realisation that it wasn't a bomber force that Britain needed, it was actually a fighter force that Britain needed. So whether it was intended or not at Munich, it did provide that a little bit of extra time for war production to produce those necessary fighters that were able to win the Battle of Britain. Didn't do much for the British Army. Frankly, as I said before, it was an army that hadn't got its head around how it would need to fight a modern war. When the British Expeditionary Force deployed to France, went under command of the French Army, as was agreed and as had happened at the end of the First World War. But the French strategy was, frankly, to have put their faith in concrete and machine guns and fixed defences. And that was really all that the British Army, frankly, was capable of doing. So the investment, when it came late, largely went to the Royal Air Force, hardly went to the Army, with the consequences that we all know.
Why did the BEF suffer from what you describe as, quote, adequate formation training for war, unquote?
Well, you just have to look to see what they were doing between September 1939, when they began to deploy to France, and May 1940, when the Germans attacked. You will find battalions, brigades, divisions extending the Maginot Line, the so-called Gort Line, extending the fixed formations, without really any conceptual understanding of how they might want to fight the Germans the second time round. People hadn't got their heads around what we now know the tactics of Blitzkrieg. I think the anticipation was that if the Germans attacked again, there would be a rerun of something looking like the First World War, where they'd expend their strength and their energy against the fixed fortifications that the French and the British had produced. Now, of course, what happened was exactly the opposite. Once the Germans attacked and violated the neutrality of Belgium and Holland, instead of staying in the fixed formations, the fixed locations of the extended Gort Line, extending the Maginot Line, the decision was taken to advance into Belgium up to the River Dyle, hastily dig in, and then they found that they were effectively outflanked by the Germans. And when the Germans struck through the Ardennes, cleaved the knife between 1st French Army and the British Expeditionary Force and the rest of the French Army as the Germans pushed towards the Channel, and frankly caused exactly that chaos, confusion and panic that the stormtroopers had in the spring offensive of 1918. But now they could do it in an armoured and mechanised way in a much more effective fashion. And And that, of course, is the whole point about so-called maneuver warfare, is to outmaneuver your enemy in time and space and thought, on the basis that when an army thinks it's lost, when a commander-in-chief thinks he's been defeated, then he has been defeated. That army has lost. And frankly, it was only the decision that Lord Gort took as the commander of the British Expeditionary Force to evacuate the BEF through Dunkirk and other ports that actually saved the British Army from not just being defeated, having been surrounded, but actually being annihilated as well. Because, frankly, that could well have happened.
The head of the BEF, Lord Gort, in fact, disobeyed orders. Isn't that correct?
Yes, he took a pretty unilateral decision that to save the army, he was going to order the evacuation with the assistance of the Royal Navy from Dunkirk. And eventually the government supported that decision, but it was not the decision that the government wanted at the time. But as events turned out, he was justified and did enable some 300,000 British and quite a large number of French troops to be evacuated. Most of the French were then returned to France, but the British obviously formed the basis of the renewed British army in order to be prepared to defend Britain should Germany try and attack itself, or indeed became the basis of the army that partly deployed to North Africa, then to Sicily and Italy, and ultimately with the Americans and others to take part in the Second Front Operation Overlord.
Why was the Norwegian campaign so disastrous for the Allies?
Well, if you want to study how not to run an overseas combined operation, then frankly, the Norway campaign is the one to study. The strategic thinking behind it was itself not unreasonable. The basis of the thinking was that Swedish iron ore was very important to the German war machine. Swedish iron ore was being exported through Norway to Germany. And therefore, if that supply could be stopped as part of the overall Allied strategy, which was to blockade Germany in the way that it had in the First World War, then interdicting the flow of iron ore from Sweden to Germany through Norway was a reasonable thing to do. Churchill was very much behind this, and part of the original thinking was to mine the waters off Norway. But then a late decision was made to actually occupy a number of the Norwegian ports. But the thinking and the planning was completely lacking. There was no overall joint commander appointed. Indeed, the commander of the naval force and the commander of the landing force only met once the operation was started, then on the quarterdeck of one of the battleships. And there's a rather delightful illustration of they met, they shook hands, they screwed their monocles into their eyes, and they looked and glared at each other. Now, that is no way to organise the commander control of an expedition force. And indeed, one or two of those battalions that took part in the landing had been in France, extending the Maginot Line throughout the winter, were suddenly removed from France back to England, found themselves shipped off to Norway without any winter warfare equipment or training or expertise. It's not surprising that the Germans walked all over the British. Now, what was also unfortunate was that the moment that the British decided that they were going to put landing troops into Norway, exactly the same moment the Germans decided that they were going to launch their invasion of Norway. The difference being is the Germans had properly planned and thought this through. The British were the come-as-you-are party, making up as you go along, and it was a disaster.
How much blame were you assigned to Churchill, who was at that point First Lord of the Admiralty?
Well, of course, this is a very interesting question. The answer is that one has to assign a certain amount of blame to him. His strategic thinking was not unreasonable, which I've just explained, about interdicting the supply of iron ore from Sweden to Germany. But if you're going to do something like that, you're going to plan an operation to interdict that, it's got to be properly thought through. It's got to be properly planned. The command and control has got to be put in place. the troops properly trained and the thing done properly. It was done very quickly. All the things that already the sky were lacking were present. Now, the ultimate irony, of course, is that the debate in the House of Commons in early May 1940 on the failures of the Norway campaign, and Churchill was due to sum up to the government at the end of that debate. It was, by that stage, the Parliament had decided that Neville Chamberlain had to go, and there was a general view that the only wartime leader that could be turned to was Winston Churchill. So in the debate, when he was having to justify himself and explain the failures of the Norway campaign, actually became his launch pad, if you like, that 2 days later resulted in him becoming Prime Minister. Quite an extraordinary twist of fate, that on the one moment he was defending himself over the Norway campaign, the next minute he was the wartime leader defending Great Britain against the Germans.
If you wanted to pick one particular variable which explains the German success in the spring of 1940 as opposed to their lack of success in the spring of 1918, what would it be?
Well, it's the march of time, really, and the German understanding. The German conceptual, doctrinal understanding was good in 1918. The concept of stormtroopers breaking through into the rear areas, that was a very reasonable set of maneuverist-type thinking. But what the Germans had successfully done is then integrate modern warfare, tanks with motorized infantry, with self-propelled artillery, and critically, the Stuka Ju-88 fighter bombers, bringing that air power. So they had in their hand an integrated strike force that was building on their original successful doctrinal thinking, but they had then incorporated modern technology, and they had a war that was ahead of its generation and actually left, frankly, the British and the French completely standing.
Now, subsequently, what explains, more than 2 years later, Montgomery's success in the Battle of El Alamein?
Well, you're absolutely right to take the conversation there. Montgomery, in the First World War, had learnt from bitter experience that, frankly, if you were going to succeed on the battlefield, you needed to get everything organised. You needed to make sure that you had your artillery support in sufficient measure, you had your logistics sorted out, and he began to favour what he called the tidy battlefield. Now, by the time he launched the second battle of El Alamein, he had the manpower, he had the artillery, he had the ammunition, he had the armour that he needed to apply force successfully. And frankly, that was what, in not just at Alamein, but through the rest of his command, especially in Sicily, and then when he commanded 21st Army Group and the land forces in Operation Overlord in 1944. And it's interesting to reflect on the fact that even though the value of manoeuvre and outmanoeuvre had been demonstrated, actually it was Montgomery's application of force in a sort of grinding way that became the dominant thinking in the British Army. And indeed, in the British Army that I joined, our tactical doctrine pamphlet was called The Application of Force, and on the front cover was a picture of Montgomery. So it was his methodical thinking, his teeing up the tidy battlefield to make sure that he ironed out as much risk as possible to get the success that he needed, became the dominant thinking. And the only exception, really, that when he chose to take a risk was over Operation Market Garden in September 1944. And as we know, that plan was too bold, it was a bridge too far, and 1st UK Airborne Division was largely destroyed.
General Dunnott, if you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
I'm afraid it's to dwell on what went wrong in the interwar years, the price to pay for not recognizing a threat, not increasing your own military capability and your ability to deter potential aggression. And of course, we have to look to see what's happening in Europe today. We haven't just got the threat of aggression from Vladimir Putin. He is a proven aggressor with what he has done and he's doing in Ukraine. And one has to ask the question, have we learned the lessons of the interwar years, and are we applying those lessons today? Frankly, we're not. I often quote certain statistics which are there in the book. In Great Britain in 1935, we spent just less than 3% of our national wealth, GDP, on defence. When appeasement had failed and the war broke out in 1939, 3% shot up to 18%. And by 1940, when we were fighting for our very survival, 18% had become 46%. That's the disastrous cost of fighting a war for which you were unprepared. Much better to increase what you do spend on defence to make sure that you're able to have a military capability that can deter a war. So where is that? Where does that place us today? Currently, the UK is spending about 2.3% of GDP on defence. The government has just committed, under some pressure from many, many of us, to commit to 2.5%. But frankly, we should be going to 3 or even 4% to make sure that we have got the military capability to deter further aggression. That's the big takeaway. The book is a cautionary tale for our times. If we study what happened in the interwar years, we've got to make sure that we're not doomed to let history repeat itself.
On that observation, Lord Dunnott, which I like to agree with entirely, I would like to thank you very much for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. You've been listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. Thank you, Lord Dunnott, very much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.